And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
I'm Bill.
You sure, Bill? I can't hear you very well. There we go. You're back
again.
Better.
There we go.
We got here really early, which of course means that, you know.
We didn't know what to do with ourselves.
There's this huge flurry at the end. We're used to coming in on the flurry and then starting off with the flurry. So let's see. I have to do a little promoting here. McDonald's Budget Printing in Reading. They are the best. They're I'll look up their stuff for another break, but if you live in Reading, they are over by the bowling alley. They're right next door to H&R Block on Bocelli Lane. And those guys, that's like the third time I've taken something in kind of last minute. And this wasn't just like, hey, can you make me some copies? It was, can you make me some giant posters of some photos and put them on poster board? And they got it all done. It was awesome. They, you know, got all the artsy fartsy stuff handled. Can I say fartsy on the air? Just kidding. they got all the artsy fartsy stuff done and made it look really good. It was posters of dead cattle, and they didn't even freak out. It was kind of fun, though, having them spread out all over the counter when some lady came in who I think was kind of a pro-wolf person. And I was going to a wolf protest, so I thought, I should make these. I'll use them over and over again. And the pictures were, I was going for gore, carnage, actually. And I think I succeeded. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Bill? You could be my independent evaluator. How was my carnage level?
Made me want to barbecue a steak.
Wolf steaks.
Yeah.
You're supposed to say it made me want to make a coat. I think that's what we were going for. We want to keep the cattle alive. Oh, man. The worst. So, anyway, if you are interested in sponsoring the show, you can go to wethepeopleradio.us, click on the sponsor link. We do have lots of people who just sponsor a little bit each month. It's kind of handy. And we do like to promote our local businesses that help us out with issues and solutions. So, yeah, if you do need printing, go down to Budget Printing there on Bocelli Lane.
Yeah, they really did turn out nice. I mean, it was
They turned out great. And they didn't gouge me. It wasn't like, oh, I should have come in a week ago. You know, we can't get it done. It's going to cost extra. Nope, they never do that. They're always really cool and super helpful. And it's very much, when they say it's a family operation on the door, I mean, they really mean it. You can, and you get kind of involved in the family, which is nice. So, what else do I have? I don't know. Earth Day, the Earth Day guys, I do have one other thing that was kind of funny. The big wolf protest up in that we were launching for Mount Shasta on Saturday, yesterday, let's see, because today is April 27th. So it was yesterday, it was their big Earth Day celebration, and they were having somebody from the Center for Biological Diversity come in and, you know, promote how great wolves are, blah, 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 which they are not. And it was kind of funny because at the last minute, they had to cancel it because of the weather. Climate change went wrong on them. And so they moved it to another, they moved it to the 4th of March, I believe it is now they're going to do, which was just sort of humorous. So not very resilient. Apparently they're all made of sugar, and if they get water on them, they're all melted. So I've got my posters ready, though. I won't have to bother the poor budget printing people for a last minute order this time. All right. That said, this time, I know last time I bungled it when we had Robert Tannenbaum on. I introduced him in the wrong hour, and then we cut him off at the end of the hour. We didn't hear the end of his story. It was kind of one of those days. So today, we're not having one of those days. He is here for the whole time, and we're going to get the entire story this time and not cut him off at the pass, because that was horrible. And I do want to know the end of the story. We asked him why he waited so long to write the book about Lee Harvey Oswald. So the book is called That Day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald Did Not Kill JFK. And there's been a lot of stuff written about this, but I always want to hear the story, right? I like reading, but hearing the story is always pretty great. And Robert Tannenbaum is the author of 33 books, and I've listed them on the page here for you today. 29 novels featuring Butch Karp and Marlene Ciampi, maybe. I probably got that wrong.
That's good.
Oh, yay. And 4 nonfiction books. I like the names. Badge of the Assassin, The Piano Teacher, because who doesn't want to read a scary book about a piano teacher? Echoes of My Soul and The Cole Country Killing. He's one of the most successful prosecuting attorneys, having never lost a felony trial and convicting hundreds of violent criminals. Three cheers for you. He was a special prosecution consultant on the Hillside Strangler case in Los Angeles and defended Amy Grossberg in her sensationalized baby death case. He was assistant district attorney in New York County in the office of legendary district attorney Frank Hogan. And from reading his bio in the past, we were watching Law and Order, like old reruns of Law and Order, and they were talking about Frank Hogan. And I thought, wait a second, I know that name. And when he was there, he ran the Homicide Bureau, served as chief of the criminal courts, and was in charge of the DA's legal staff training program. Robert also served as the deputy chief counsel for the Congressional Committee investigation into the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Well, let's see. He also did two terms. So now we move to, like, the lighter side, right, which was probably fraught with drama, but he was a two-term mayor of Beverly Hills. Sounds like a fun gig, but it was probably hell. and then just for fun, he taught advanced criminal procedure for 4 years in Berkeley, in the law school at Berkeley. So not everybody who came out of Berkeley was a goofball, apparently. Did you weed the goofballs out for us, Robert, during that time?
Oh, Christ, it was an amazing time. I mean, the last thing I thought about was going to Berkeley, and I went there on a basketball scholarship, and it was a time where in 1961, where I went there in the summer of 61, and spent my college and law school at Berkeley, but I never thought for a minute that it was as organized as it was. There were a lot of good people, actually, who were getting totally different politics from me, but they were getting signatures on in the South for voter registration drives and all those kinds of things that, frankly, I had never heard about. And I was just hoping I could hit the outside jump shot with consistency, if you get my drift. So it was a great experience. There was more to be learned and discussed and argued outside the classrooms than they were really in. But I will say this about the whole experience. Unlike what we're seeing today, not one of my professors, undergraduate or in law school, did I ever detect them trying to proselytize or give their philosophy in the course. It never happened to my knowledge, and I was concerned about that, and I was on the ready. But it just went to show you what the faculty was made up of them. There was respect for the First Amendment. There was respect for other people's opinions, and it was made clearly about who they were and what the opinions were and how the students felt about it and questions and answers. And believe me, I had many an hour of debate with my professors, notwithstanding the fact that, as I said, there was no proselytizing going on at all. And there was just interpretations of what the Constitution had to say, which we can go on forever about. But it was a fabulous experience, and you know, it's always stayed with me. And let me, I can get now to, before I go, you know, I'm in my office, so before I leave here, you said everything that has to be said about me, for crying out loud. It's unbelievable. Is this me you're talking about, or what? Teaching at Berkeley was another phenomenon. I mean, it was kind of a thing where you want to hear other points of view, particularly from the students, and what they're backing it up with. And that's what the exercises were about at the time. And those exercises were, you have something to say it, but make sure you got some research you did here, and you're just not shooting your mouth off the left. So it was that kind of a hit and miss kind of thing. Now, let me answer the first question you asked, if I may. It's exceedingly personal, but I appreciate the opportunity to come back here and speak with you guys. And that is, in 1919, I was diagnosed. I started this book before that. My last book, my novel, Without Fear or Favor, was in 2017. And that was Simon Schuster who published it. And then I had this gap. And my new book, That Day in Dallas, is now scheduled for publication on June 10th, I believe. Yeah, June 10th. They keep backing it out a little bit because the publishers got some, could use some descriptive words for this, but I dare not. I mean, if we're concerned about artsy-fartsy, then believe me, I'm way out of my league. And the publication has been moved up and back and up and back because of the tremendous publicity about these 80,000 pages. You know, and let me start with that for a second. I don't want to insult anybody's intelligence, but would it offend anybody's intelligence if I suggested that for 62 years, our government has lied to us? Our government knowingly has contrived a predetermined conclusion through the pretense of an investigation. And both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee disregarded all convincing and trustworthy evidence to the contrary. I'll go through all that when we chat about it. But I want you to know what the point of view was that I left Washington with and had no knowledge of it, nor did I have a brief one way or the other before we started this investigation with Dick Sprague, who was the chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and in October of 76 asked me to come to Washington. He was chief counsel and staff director, and he wanted me to be in charge of the subcommittee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. The other subcommittee was the investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King. So that's how I got involved with this thing. And Sprague and I, after we met and worked together, we started January 1st, 77. And as you know, all these select committees have a life of 2 years. So at the end of 78, this committee would dissolve. And before they dissolved, they wrote out their reports, particularly with people who, Sprague and I, we were promised from each member of the committee that they would not interfere with our investigation. And as I said, when we went to Washington, and I never knew Dick Sprague. I didn't know he was legend in Pennsylvania, chief assistant DA in Philadelphia. And when I say for 2 years I tried at least 2 cases a month, that's why I never say how many cases that I tried. It was ridiculous. You do the math. And Sprague is the only person who prosecuted more cases than I can honestly say, with a good heart about it all. Because he's an extraordinary lawyer, brilliant. And what I respected most about him was I was trained by the best, two of the best assistant DAs who ever served for Frank Hogan, and by Hogan himself, who never wavered about doing the right thing. Believe me, Echoes of My Soul is a book all about that. And I was asked to write that book by Mel Glass, who was my mentor in the DA's office because of what Hogan went through in that case, but never mentored, never wavered about the search for truth, even though that search for truth, people in the office for like 20, 25 years told him, take a plea from a guy we know who's not guilty, but no one will know that we locked up the wrong guy. It was a 19-year-old black kid. And the kid wouldn't even know how to get from where he lived in Jersey to Brooklyn to visit his aunt. And you would know that just from talking to him over a very short period of time. But the Brooklyn detectives who questioned him, he fed back to them what the leading questions were throughout the entire process of being questioned for about 17 hours. And the senior staff told Hogan that just take the plea from this guy and we'll wipe our hands of the case and it'll be tried in Brooklyn. And that's when Hogan, and I heard this from Mel Glass, who was present at this meeting, and Hogan stood up and he said, let me get this straight. You're asking me to take a plea from a man we know who is innocent for two murders committed in Manhattan. And you want Brooklyn people to handle his cases. There are two murder cases in Brooklyn involved with this case. And yes, said the staff people, going along with this notion. And Hogan said, well, we know he's innocent also in Brooklyn. What I want to know is, from each one of you, I really want to know this before you leave this room. I want to know, when did it become so corrupt that we would take a plea from someone we know is innocent so that I could save my ass?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I don't know of anyone. I don't know of, this was the case, by the way, because the two girls were murdered, Janice Wiley and Emily Hoffert, the so-called Korea girl murders. You can look that one up. Brutal, vicious case of the killing. I mean, knifing, disemboweling, cutting off necks and so on by the killer. And this was not Whitmore, George Whitmore. And so Hogan's people said, this case is the case. People are, this was, they jumped in, the killer jumped in. through the seventh, through the third floor window in a so-called fashionable Upper East Side, doorman, the whole works. And if people were getting murdered in their third, and the window was open, it was a hot August day in 63 when this happened, and the public was of the state of mind, and this is one time I think I can say the media got it right, is that people were afraid. If that's what happens in a fancy schmancy building, what the heck, where, how are we supposed to survive? And so what they were asking Hogan to do was to avoid having to say he locked up the wrong guy. And that he now took a plea from the guy who was not the wrong guy, but no one would know that. Except he would know it, his staff would know it. And that was something that, when I heard this, of course, I was not surprised. And what Hogan did was, at the end of that meeting, he wanted resignation papers from everyone. And, you know, Glass, he told me that he asked Mel Glass what Mel thought. Mel was only in the office at the time for 6 years, not in the Homicide Bureau, just in the, what we call the Felony Trial Bureau. And Mel said, Mr. Hogan, if you don't dismiss this case, it'll ruin not only your legacy, but your life. Hogan said, get downstairs and do justice, Mel. Mel went downstairs, dismissed the case. A year later, Mel found the real killer. And it's a tremendous story, echoes of my soul. I urge you to take a look at it, and you'll understand what I'm saying. Because if you want to know what DA should be doing in their career, read this book. This is what it's all about.
Wow.
It's not about these political characters who now have so perverted justice. It's so disgusting to me what they've done. How do they live with themselves?
Well, some of these judges just lately, like this last week, I totally thought of you. I thought, I bet his hair is on fire. You know, that you have judges that would usher a criminal out the back door and try to shield him from the police. And
I mean, I never heard of anything like this.
It's crazy.
Totally crazy stuff. And it's mind-blowing to me about when I look at these people. You know, it used to be when I went into the courtroom, always we had on a suit, whenever you went into the courtroom. Now, when I walk into a courtroom on a matter that I'm retained for example, and I don't know who the DA is, who the defendant is, or who the defense attorney is, they all look alike. And I say that
that's not a ringing endorsement.
No, I mean, we're talking about people dressed. They're not dressed for court. And next thing you know, they'll be in basketball shorts walking into the courtroom with a T-shirt. So there's no respect for process, for the things that truly matter. And dress is important. I mean, it's an indication of when you do walk into a courtroom, you look like you belong there the way you should be. But let me go back to this.
Yeah, well,
I'm
immediately, Bill is giving me the high sign on John Fetterman. You know, I mean, look what's happening right in the Senate, right? We got a guy.
Exactly.
We got a guy in a sweatshirt who's representing a state. What the heck?
Yeah.
Robert, we have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come right back.
I'm with you.
Got a little balled up on the music there. I got here early today, and as I've previously confessed, being early is not all that helpful for me. I'm better on the run. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, and we're going to go through like a lot of his different books and stuff today. I put on there that it was part two on the book about the assassination of JFK, but I believe we're going to have a wide-ranging conversation, as we call them. Be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
People think I'm crazy because I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, or this world you love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now, but I don't think so, because there's a jungle out there. There's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there.
Come a little closer than you see. Come on, come on, come on. Do you understand the things that you can see? Come on, come on, come on. Do you understand the things that you can see?
I bet that would be a great theme song for one of your books if they ever turn it into, if they ever need some background music. It sounds like most of the things you've written about are not exactly what they seem.
So true.
All right, so go back to where we were.
All right, where we were was, you know, why did I wait this long to do this book? And as I, and it's very important also, I have to get the culture into this with respect to what was happening. You know, it's funny you mentioned Fetterman. Clearly, in the most favorable way to refer to him, in my judgment, is bizarre. But given the nature of what is at stake with all these votes, don't think I'm not rooting for him to vote the way I believe he could vote.
Well, I mean, all joking about his outfits aside, honestly, at the beginning, it was like, wait, this is like Weekend at Bernie's. And then suddenly...
He's like the voice of reason.
Yeah, he's like the most common sense guy over there. I'm thinking, okay, well...
Yeah, amazing. If we can say that about him, that's how far down this road we've tumbled, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But it is interesting in that regard. And there's just as I get into, you know, discussing with you why I had changed the nature of this book, and it had everything to do with my perceptions and how things that affect us. We deal with, particularly in writing, that these things aren't just done in isolation. If they are, you're missing the boat. In my judgment, it's all in my judgment. I'm not telling anybody how to live or do or dress for crime. That's their business.
Sure.
But the cultural issue about all this is very fascinating to me. And I'll give you just a couple of quick examples. In the early 60s, three people came to see Chief Justice Earl Warren. Again, keep in mind who these players are. Earl Warren was a political character. He didn't make it through scholarship as a law review student. He was the Attorney General of California. He was involved in the DA's office for a period of time in San Francisco and so on. And three people came to see him. Henry Wade, who was the district attorney in Dallas, and Wagoner Carr, who was the Attorney General of Texas, and Wagoner Carr's lawyer, Leon Jaworski, who we get to know a little bit better 10 years from this period of time. Anyway, they say to the Chief Justice, "We have information that Lee Harvey Oswald was a contract employee of the CIA and the FBI." That's their term. From unimpeachable sources. And the Chief Justice says, "Oh, well, we'll investigate that." Which was a natural thing for him to say, notwithstanding his particular background in law enforcement. And Alan Dulles, who was there, who JFK fired, as you may recall, as a result of the fiasco called the Bay of Pigs. And that was in 1961. And Dulles wormed his way on to the Warren Commission, et cetera, et cetera. And he was replaced by John McCone. And McCone was very much a pro-JFK person. And I'll get to this McCone document also in a moment. But when Alan Dulles said, when the Chief Justice said, "We'll investigate this case," Alan Dulles said, "Wait a minute. What do you think you're doing?" All this is on record in an executive session. And the Chief Justice said, "Well, we'll investigate this. What are you suggesting?" "Well, I'm saying to you that right now, if you have J. Edgar Hoover, then head of the FBI, he'll simply say, 'I checked the records,' and he never worked for the FBI." Hmm. And, you know, he's upset with us because he's already determined that Lee Harvey Oswald is the assassin here, and there were three shots taken from the back in the depository 6-4 window, the sniper, so-called sniper's nest. And the Chief Justice said, "You mean to tell me that if I were to question an agent under oath, he would lie?" Alan Dulles, "If he were a good agent, he would." "Well," the Chief Justice said, "who will he tell the truth to?" Maybe the president. And that's the first part of the culture of what we're talking about here. If we can talk and have a conversation about alleged good FBI agents. And this is such a slam at the FBI because they're so essential in doing what their original, their job is. And that is to root out information and so on and give it to the president. If they're not involved in politics, or so we thought and pray, and that day is over, hopefully. But the bottom line here is we want the CIA, we want the FBI to make decisions from immutable evidence, which I use in all the cases I tried. Immutable evidence, it can't be in any way refuted. It's scientifically there when you have it, audio, visual, acoustics, et cetera, all of which plays a role in this whole thing. But it was somewhat shocking to hear that coming from the Chief Justice of the United States. And then there's another cultural issue that I found incredible, but I want to share with you, your audience. And that is, at the end of the late summer of 1978, remember the House Select Committee on Assassination started on January 1st, 77. Sprague asked me to go down there with him in March in October of 76. And we went down together and worked together. And as I said, the committee guaranteed they wouldn't interfere in the investigation. It took them 4 months to lie to us. And I went to see Lou Stokes in a meeting that, you know, tells you the whole story in a nutshell. Lou Stokes was the chairman of this committee, the House Select Committee. He's from Cleveland, Ohio. His brother was the first black mayor of Cleveland. And Lou was a very good man in my judgment. He was the ultimate representative defense attorney in Cleveland. And I went with him with two subpoenas. And the subpoenas were that based upon the information, particularly that I had from Richard Schweiker, you remember Senator Richard Schweiker, he conducted an investigation and called me up and wanted to give me his file because he had a subcommittee that he was on from Senate Church Committee on the executive committee's intelligence responses to the assassinations of Kennedy and King. And he was in charge of the subcommittee on the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. Similarly, that was the Senate side of this thing, and I was on the structure having to do with the House. That was the House Select Committee, and investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. And Schweiker handed me his file and said, "This is the first week I'm in Washington." And you know, I had mentioned, I don't want to forget, sometimes I mention this stuff and it floats around the ether. The reason I had so much respect for Sprague was I was trained, as I said, by the best who worked in that office. Sprague had no training. This was all intuitive and study and work on how you maneuver if round in a courtroom. And that's why I had so much respect for him. Everyone who trained me expected me to do the right thing. And I appreciated that, believe me. But Sprague had a different point of view. Nevertheless, the point of view that I wanted to quickly share from Richard Schweiker, senator from Pennsylvania, he was a middle-of-the-road Republican. And he said that when he gave me the file, the CIA will be obstructionists, which they've already been, and I will tell you in short circuits everything for you, that in my judgment, which you'll get from the notion of the file, that the CIA participated in the assassination of the President of the United States. I had just come from the DA's office. I was running the Homicide Bureau. I was running the criminal courts. In the criminal courts, we had 250 new cases a day, 7 days a week. And that went from, you know, trespassing up to murder. And it was my responsibility to try to get some organization on dispositions so that we could get some quality dispositions on plea bargaining and not plea bargain the whole case away, which is the custom that goes on too much in too many DA's offices around the country. So I wasn't aware of Sprague, as I mentioned to you, and so on, but I sure became aware of him when we worked together. He was everything that you would want to see from someone who had his position. And again, anyone in Pennsylvania who had a murder case, or much less a felony case, would go to see Sprague, the chief assistant DA in Philly. And what Schweiker meant, and what he said to me from the whole issue of who was responsible for what, he said that JFK was shot in the Wright Temple area from the front of the Kennedy limo on the back side of it, that is to say, it's the area where the stockade fence is, and you can detect it when you look at the film. You'll see it's immediately to the right of where Zapruder is filming with his business colleague. And he's looking in that area, because in that area there were shots fired, according to witnesses who were sitting on the grass area, standing around there, right in front of the stockade fence area. And they were claiming that their shots were sailing over their head. So it becomes an important area in this whole case. Again, that Kennedy was shot in the right front temple area, above the right ear, in the front of Kennedy from the stockade fence. And important, obviously, in the whole case when we go through this, because in my judgment, why this hasn't been written about from the point of view of evidence, the evidence is overwhelming now when we go over all this stuff. That, you know, we'll talk about what happened, the truth about Dealey Plaza, for example, and go right through it. So Lou Stokes said to me when I said I understand that there is information, written information from the CIA that explains whether or not the CIA was responsible for the assassination and its participation, or it was a rogue member of the CIA. That was the level of what's going on here. And Stokes said that the majority of the committee is not in support. They're not going to. This is after 4 months. They promised 4 months ago, on January 1st, 1977, that they would definitely, not interfere, because we would not want to be part of an investigation that anyway was tampered with, that lacked search for truth, integrity, and authenticity. And Stokes said to me that the majority is not going to support and give you any of these, subpoenas. I said, why you hire me? I told you not to hire me. During the presentation, I said to them they wanted to see me when Sprague appointed me. And of course, I went down there to meet them. And I was listening to them pontificate about all this nonsense, and I was very worried about this. And I said to him, look, I don't think you should hire me. And the reason is that I believe that the only way the House of Representatives can function is if you have compromise. You can't have, 315 or whatever the number happens to be at any given time, independent executives. That's Article 2, the executive branch. Article 1 is legislative branch. And I will never compromise on search for truth. I will not do it. So I don't think I'm the person you should hire. No, Sprague wants you, we want you, kind of thing. So as I said, it took him 4 months to demonstrate what a lie that was.
Well, on that note, we have to take another quick break, but it just seems that I must have been channeling you, because I have picked an old song that just seems to hit it right on the head. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum. We're going to come back with him right after this speedy break here at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
Thought you'd change the weather, start a little storm, make a little rain. But I'm gonna do one better, hide the sun until you pray. I'm a tornado, looking for a soul to take. You're gonna see me coming by the selfish things that you did. I'm gonna leave you guessing how this funnel is gonna hit. I'm a tornado, looking for a man to break.
They said, hey, Robert, how about you compromise? And then you gave him the tornado, right?
Oh, geez, I tell you, I want to go home and visit you guys and just listen to that. have a nice martini in my hand and let it really roll. That's all I can tell you.
I was totally laughing. I'm like, when you started talking about that, I was trying to make you compromise. I'm like, I don't know why that seemed like a good song, but there it is right there. Yeah, because I do.
So true.
I can't even imagine. And you know, we've all been there. You know, you go in, you tell somebody right, straight up, don't pick me if you're gonna, and then they do it anyway, and they think they can browbeat you.
Like, yeah, exactly. Well, they figure, you know, I don't have anywhere to go. It wasn't like I had some jobs lined up. And it just didn't even occur to me because, you know, that I have to stay on because I need the blessed job routine. I hate when I hear that from people, particularly in law enforcement, particularly really good FBI people who have they've compromised themselves, which I would urge them never to do, on their integrity. And that is to say, well, we knew. In other words, if there's corruption in the FBI, which there was from the political appointees of these hacks, I mean, we know who they are and were. They weren't the line people who were out there in the field. But the people who were the FBI people, good people, knew exactly what was going on, in my judgment. And they didn't want to get involved in matters that they were not assigned, because if they did and they searched for truth, they would lose their job.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a family to support. And I understand that and I respect that. But that's not what your job is, particularly when you're in law enforcement. Get another job. Trust me, you can do it. I've lived through it with the whole thing, and I never even thought about it. You know, there's nothing being brave said by me at all. It's just the reality of, you know, going to an interview and answering any of the questions that anyone has, just as we're doing now, and let the four of them see what their chips fall. You know, you don't want to be part of something that is less than sincere, particularly when you're dealing with these kinds of issues, which transcend the average, you know, kind of thing. Was there a shoplift in this case? And all that crap that goes with it. I mean, can you imagine our system today? You can shoplift for $950 and not get arrested? What world are they living in, really? What world are they living in?
Do you think this is where the corruption in the FBI started? Because, I mean, they've always had a stellar reputation as the, you know, the
Absolutely.
Best law enforcement. And
right. And
now it just seems like all you hear about is corruption in the FBI. And I know there's tons of good FBI agents out there. Don't get me wrong. But it seems like the higher they go, the corruption starts.
Do we just promote the bad ones, or do they get bad?
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, the problem is they've so politicized everything, starting Mr. Obama et al., that they wanted to have all this stuff done just the way they do when you're dealing with a Marxist regime. You know, people can say what they want about the worst president ever, but in my judgment, the worst person who ever served in that office was Obama. He understood. He's what I call a Marxist, limited Marxist, to the extent that he knows not to. He knows he's been trained. If you look at his background and read his own materials,
yeah.
He's been trained to in getting engaged in this kind of conduct and be a minimalist and not ask for too much so that he shows exactly who he is. And it's very dangerous. And what he's done is he's corrupted the system in large measure with people who he appointed to the FBI and to the courts, by the way, that we're talking about. And because you have to wonder how these people are judges doing what they're doing. And you know what the equivalency of it is I made a note to myself to mention to you guys. It's like the Emancipation Proclamation, 1863. And it's as if, given these district court judges, all of a sudden they have national prominence. They have the ability to stop everything the president's doing. And they're district court judges. It's the equivalent of someone going to Abe Lincoln, our president, and saying, a district court judge has just found that you are never to mention Emancipation Proclamation again. It's banned. You're banned from that.
Yeah.
Same damn thing.
Yeah, how's that
when
work?
When's the government going to wake up and tell these judges, your jurisdiction extends as far as the courtroom you're in, period? That's what's sickening to me, is how the justice system has been corrupted this way.
Well, you know, you start with the judicial, or not the judicial, the executive branch. You've got corruption there. And then it trickles into the judicial branch. And there's exactly. there's no surprise now that now we're seeing these judges, making their own rules and everybody going along with it. I'm hoping that what we have now is some folks that are going to put an end to this, but it's all trickled down. It's all trickled down.
It's kind of funny too, because what you hear from the left all the time is, you know, the law is the law, and you're like, well, ship's kind of sailed.
It's very sickening because of the children involved in our future and so on. I shudder to think of what's being taught in these schools and how hideous it is to listen to what's going on. I mean, why are people obsessed, and they happen to be so-called Democrats, with kids who are 3, 5, 6 years old and being taught and what, all the sexuality that they want to talk about?
Yeah.
What is going on there? What is going on with these characters? They need to be analyzed. They need to have shrinks at these meetings, I think.
We do have a psychiatrist on next week, the terrorist therapist. She's talking about, you know, all these political protests in the colleges and how they're just, you know, fomenting terrorism here at home.
Precisely. You know, it's almost a joke of the Yankees, for example. They have Aaron Judge. Oh, they say he's so great. The guy cannot hit in October. They should have a psychiatrist on the bench under there. How do you not hit in a month of the season where the only thing that's really involved is the World Series? Gee whiz. How do you, I mean, it's mind-bogglingly incredible what's going on. So anyway, you know, back to our story here. And that story continues for a very, very brief moment on this culture issue that I mentioned. And I just wanted to mention one quick point of view here, and that was in defining, going through all the documents, I ran into President Truman's memo, which I call a memo. It's a document dated 12/22/63, and he indicated, which surprised me a lot. All of this surprised me, I must tell you. Again, coming from the DA's office in Manhattan, running the Homicide Bureau and the criminal courts, come on. And Truman indicated a major misgiving of the CIA, that he was very, very upset with himself that he permitted the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the main intel organization during the war, and he let it morph into the CIA. And the reason was, he said, the CIA has become operational. And at times they form policy, and they become an arm of the government. And then we have a lot of trouble we've had, he says, that compounded difficulties in several explosive areas because of what the CIA has done. And then there was this McCone document, which is really a kicker here, and I want to mention this because of what the government tries to do with respect to it. As I mentioned to you before, Mr. Rowley, James Rowley, was chief of the Secret Service at this time. This is March 3rd, 1964. And he wrote a letter to McCone, John McCone, who was the head of the CIA, and he became head of the CIA, as I said, in 61, when Alan Dulles was fired because of the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs. Guess what? Alan Dulles' information wasn't exactly right. He said the people would be waiting for the Americans to come in and free them from tyranny. It didn't go that way. And there was supposed to be, this is a wonderful aside, there was supposed to be American bombing, air cover, as they refer to it. And JFK hadn't engaged in it yet, but now he was about to, because the whole thing became farcical. The people waiting on the beaches were not people welcoming the American soldiers. And so Bobby Kennedy, according to my investigative information, was that he got JFK into a private room, and he told JFK, "What is your plan now?" He said, "Well, we've got to use the air cover here, otherwise they'll blame me for the failure." He said, "I'm going to tell you something right now. You're never going to use that air cover." And the president looked at him, frozen in his tracks, and said, "What do you mean?" He said, "If you use the air cover, it'll be no different from what the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor. And then you're not going to do it. It will destroy your life. It'll destroy your legacy. It's not who you are." JFK then left that room and said, "There'll be no air cover." To this day, there are meetings of that whole crowd that blames that was at the Bay of Pigs, and they blamed JFK because he didn't use the air cover. Just so you put all this into context of what's going on. So now we have this Rowley document, this John McCone document of March 3rd, 64, in response to James Rowley of the Secret Service, because Rowley was concerned, as were the people in the government, that the American public was being lied to about who Oswald was and whether or not he was an agent of the CIA and the FBI. So they were trying to cover this up. So in this two-page letter, which is really three pages, the third page is a signature page, McCone refers to the leaks and on Oswald's training and suspect activities. In one page, and it covers a lot of information about Oswald and how he was involved. We knew from the investigation that Oswald, since 1957, was involved at Atsugi Air Force Base monitoring U-2 flights. As you may recall, Gary Powers' U-2 flight was shot down, and the government, that is to say, Vice President Nixon at the time and Ike President, Ike was lied to by Nixon. And no one in Brooklyn who grew up in my neighborhood thinks that's a surprise, by the way, but that's personal. Nixon was involved in saying that we would have air cover in 1959, before the 60 election. And he swore to President Eisenhower that no one had that plane. In order to have that plane, we would have had a mole in the organization. And Ike's response was, let's find that mole then.
Yeah.
And that's how they used Oswald as well. But from 57 on, he was an agent to the CIA and the FBI, and monitoring these flights. And they had Angleton, who was head of our intel internationally, had used Oswald to say, "I am now resigning. I renounce my citizenship in the United States government, et cetera, et cetera. And I have important information." The idea was to get the mole. They never got the mole. No big deal. No, nothing there. But here's what McCone wrote. Because the government has tried to make it a fake. This is what I love about our government. Find information that's contrary to what their whole presentation is, which is a fraud, in this case particularly, and say it's not true. And here's what is true. He says McCone, in response to Rowley's concern about the leaks and the LHO training and suspect activity, I am concerned that if this information in any way is disclosed to the wrong persons, meaning the media, it would lead the media to erroneously claim that the CIA and perhaps others were directly involved in the Dallas action. That's how they refer to the assassination. And then he says, this is on page two, which is basically paragraph 6 of the letter. While the persons involved in the assassination were in the employ of this agency, as well as the FBI, it is impossible to maintain full 24-hour-a-day responsibility over its agents.
Wow.
And now, you know, I read this thing when I first started about 10 times. So what did the government do when they realized that this thing was out there? They claimed that it was a fake. So I immediately said, who in their right mind, by the way, let's assume the government's telling the truth. Let's just make that a crazy assumption here. Who in their right mind, right now, when I just read to you? What, are people walking around Washington who are one of whom was the head of the CIA responding to an important inquiry from the chief of the Secret Service, and someone makes this up? Now, how do we know this is a fraud, this makeup thing? And there was a book written by Dick Russell. He is a person who should be interviewed more. I never met him.
Robert, because we're going to get cut off by the news again.
We'll get a little news break
and a little coffee, and then we're going to come back and have you as our hostage for the second hour. Yay!
All right.
I knew we'd run out of time.
Okay.
You're listening to We
I'm
the
here.
People,
I'm
and
here.
You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm running down a dream you never would come to me. Working on a mystery. Going wherever it leads. Running down.
second hour of We the People Radio. We are here on April 27th, 2025. Guarantee you we are going to play this show again in the future. But our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, and he has written a book. He's written a bunch of books, actually, a zillion books, and 33 to be exact. This one that we've been discussing kind of the surrounding data for, the day in, that day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill JFK, and the book will be coming out soon. I think it was supposed to be coming out in May, but now it's coming out in June. But we decided during the break, Robert, that pretty much we could listen to you tell us stories like every day. We're just going to change our show. We're going to call it the Robert Tannenbaum Show and just have you on every week. We'll be like,
you guys are great. You
we'll be like, hi, this is Aaron and Bill. Robert's telling us a story. Everybody be quiet.
Because
you know what? It's like, I don't know about you, but in growing up in the 60s, I mean, we listened to our relatives tell us stories. When we'd go to my grandma's house, mm-hmm. we would just sit there and the relatives would all just tell stories. We didn't watch TV. We didn't watch ball games. We didn't do any of that stuff. We mm-hmm. listened to them tell us stories. And I don't know. I don't know that we do that so much. But as a, I think humans are hardwired for stories. You know, we're just.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the grandmothers. I lived the first 12 years of my life in Brooklyn, shared a bedroom with my brother, who's 4 years older than I, and every Friday night, I would go with my mother and my aunt, my mother's younger sister, to my grandma's house, my mother's mother, and it was her an apartment in a brownstone, and we would have dinner every Friday night together, and I attribute this to what I'm about to tell you to my grandmother, and that is, you never know where you're going to learn certain things, and things happen that affect your life.
Yeah.
One of which was, of course, the great love and affection and all the kinds of things that, you know, I was helping my grandma do whatever she asked me to do with respect to, you know, putting in the bread into the oven and the egg sauce around it, so we had sprinkles on it, and so on and so forth. And in other words, the least amount of expertise to do anything. But it was so much fun being with her. And she said to me one day, and this is, you know, going through ages like 5 to 7, 8 years old, she said to me, "Bobby, you got to stop doing what you're doing." And I was eating. And I said, "What is the matter, Grandma?" She said, "You're eating with your left hand." And I said, "Yes, I'm a lefty." She said, "No, only the Germans eat with their left hand."
Oh.
I said, "What?" Yeah. I said, "What?" And I couldn't think of anything less, you know, important than how I ate, you know, with my left hand. And she said, "No, the Germans eat with your left hand. You can't do that." Well, as a result of that, what I'm about to tell you is true. I did everything then with my right hand, and including playing ball. And to this day, and when I was playing ball, I would receive the inbound pass and start off my dribble going down court with my right hand, and then flipping that ball over to what we called a crossover back in the day.
Yeah.
And then power the person at the top of the key, the top of the foul line area, and just power them with my left hand and what we called the crossover dribble. And I get a kick out of it because, but for that, I would have been surely a left-handed player, dribble, shoot, and the whole routine. But because she was so emphatic about it, and the last thing I would ever want to do is have my grandmother disappointed in me.
Yeah.
And my mother never made an issue about it at all. I mean, you know, it was never even a close question about anything like that. But I was so, which is why it was so strange for her to say something like that, and I sure as heck wasn't going to disappoint her. But here it is, a simple thing of going to grandma's house for Friday night dinner. And, you know, my brother and I were huge eaters. I was like 180 pounds and 6'5", when I was in high school. But, you know, when someone says a cookie fell on the floor, I'm not going to eat it, in my house the cookie never made it to the floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My dress, no, you know what I'm talking about?
No, I'm the oldest of five kids. No cookies made it to our floor either. now.
That's exactly right. So anyway, I got a kick out of you mentioning grandma. That to me is really warms the cockles of my heart, as I will tell you.
It's true, but though. Anyway. You know, we always listened to the stories, you know, and and so my younger brothers and sisters to this day will say, "How do you know that?" And I'm like, because they told the story like 100 times. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, what were you in the womb?
Oh yeah, you were.
My kids say that to me. Oh, yeah, we only heard this 100 times.
And right.
Did I say this to you? Did I tell you this? This is what blah 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 blah. Anyway,
it is kind of funny. And as you, my last aunt just died a week ago, and so now I have one uncle and a cousin. And then I'm the third oldest person in our family, and it's like, all of a sudden, you feel kind of this pressure, you know? Yikes.
I know the other guys don't know
any of these stories. Like, maybe I better write it down.
This is it. It's so much a treasure in our lives to have that opportunity that it's not something shared by that, every year, I think it gets less and less, but to have that privilege, which I consider that to be wonderful, just sitting there listening. Because my grandmother would come over on Saturday nights and sit by my bed, and I'm, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and regale me with stories.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, the typical stuff, but the stories that she would make up, and she was some storyteller. And so when you think about all these things, And the only thing that I do remember without question was the sweat coming off my head into my bed because we had no air conditioning. We had,
trust me, you know, I grew up in Connecticut sweating just like you. Yeah.
Yeah, and we had no fan, no AC. You know?
I know. I don't know how much fans were. I laugh about that to this day. We had one fan. It was in my two brothers shared a room. It was in their room at the end of the hall. There was like a draw fan in the window that made, you know, like, I mean, it was like if an ant was blowing air on you, it was about that much air came out my window.
Exactly.
And you're laying in your bed, and it's like, it's so horrible. There was no air conditioning in school or home or car or anywhere.
Exactly. Exact window. Amazing.
Yeah.
But you know what? We made it. We made it.
Yeah, and we played sports then. Like, I played field hockey, and we played outdoor sports in the summertime, and you think, I don't know, that would probably be considered, you know, cruel and inhuman. Well, I was laughing at the beginning of the hour. You know, the environmentalist here canceled their Earth Day celebration because they thought it might rain. I was like, oh boy, civilization's almost over.
Totally. That's exactly right. What I love are about the climate people. The world has already ended several times. You know, they got to go back to the drawing boards on that one.
Yeah, Bill keeps pretty close track of Al Gore's list, and we regularly mock him. But mocking is another skill that we've tried to ban, but it's not really taking. And thank God President Trump came back with, you know, a little New York spice, some mocking, and some terrific, names. The name calling I really miss. I don't know, maybe it's an East Coast thing with the name calling.
Yeah, without question. I mean, thank God for him. That's all I have to say. And I can't imagine what we would be doing with respect to him not being president now.
Yep.
And what I also think is that Elon Musk, in this process of revealing the corruption, now we know how Biden has 3 houses on the beach in Delaware.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the president to get involved with his team and let us know how it is that all of this is, that we've always talked about, generally speaking, once we started telling stories on Saturday nights, that how do you make 100,000 a year, let's say, as an elected official and wind up with 3 houses on the beach?
Yeah.
And we know the answer. We know the answer. But what I want the public to know is that the money that has allegedly gone under this, the rubric of, guess what? This is where the money went to. And these absurd places, absurd things that had nothing to do, you know, with anything rational, because the money never went there. the money went directly. The elected officials, in my judgment, glommed the money. Period. They never put it to these crazy things that the table of contents make you just shake your head, and you can't stop shaking your head. You got to put two hands on your head so your head doesn't fall off.
But isn't it amazing that you have people that are just absolutely hysterical that they're looking into all of this? And I'm thinking,
I don't understand what they're thinking.
Yeah,
what? They think it's okay to be corrupt? Is that what the Democrat Party is now?
I don't know, but I might be or might not be tormenting, you know, maybe some liberal people in my neighborhood with small garden flags that I hang out front, and I might have accidentally found one yesterday that says, "Even my dog loves Elon." That might be showing up on Wednesday, and I can't wait to put it out. I don't understand. How do you defend all of that? It seems... I bet you feel like you woke up every now and then in a world that you don't recognize.
Without question, it is so disturbing. And when you have a guy like Musk, the world's richest man, and I'd like to know what his interest income is for a month. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, get out of here. This is ridiculous. And people want to take him on and be nasty. And, you know, the guy can hire 100 lawyers at the flip of a coin. You know, you'll have them all over the lot, like ants, you know, sprawling around the kitchen somewhere. So, anyway, you know, back to let me finish this off for you.
Yeah, sorry.
I just don't want to keep it open-ended. No, that's all right. I'm just saying that what happened was the government then decided, you know, that this was not so and so on and so forth. And what happened was I certainly looked into it with its authenticity, and it's 1,000% accurate. That is... The McCone, the response to Rowley's request of John McCone, head of the CIA, and in that response, which is dated March 3rd, 1964, he talks about that while the persons involved in the assassination worked for this agency, the CIA, and he goes on and, you know, saying that it's impossible to maintain a full 24-hour-a-day responsibility over its operatives, is such a, you know, it's so hideous. And that what I did was, in some of the research, was this goes back to a researcher who, during the House, in 1978, as I mentioned early on, in 1977, in January, Sprague and I started our investigation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And in 4 months, the government decided that we had gone too far, and that's when I left off in telling you. I said to Lou Stokes, "Why'd you hire me?" And he said, "The truth is that the majority," and he always kept himself out of this thing, Lou, and he said, "The majority didn't think you'd get to this dirty mess with the evidence you've amassed so soon, if at all." So I just stared at him, and he said, "Well, what's your next move?" It's like a chess game we're playing here. I was invited down to do something. We, Sprague and I, were doing it. They promised they wouldn't interfere, and now they're totally destroying it. And I said, "I will tell you right now," as I leaned forward on my desk, on my club chair here in your office, looking you squarely in the eye and tell you, "I officially resign right now. I don't want anything to do with this investigation from this point on." And as I left the office, his office, I said, I turned to him and I said, "Does this include Richard Sprague as well?" And he said, "Yes, absolutely." I said, "Good. I'm sure Sprague will have a word or two to talk to you about." And I went and I talked to Dick and I told him what happened. So what's important here is that in 78, during the House Select Committee on Assassinations, a key member, an extremely credible member of the staff, discovered the copy of this document. This document of what we call the McCone document, of the March 3rd, 64 document. And having found this copy of the document, and he took it from the Oswald file at the end of the investigation. And there's also a video confessional confirming this. But also from, the letter was mentioned in a book by Dick Russell, who's a very respectable research person. Look, a lot of the people who are researchers are off the charts somewhere, flying around the universe. But there are also a lot of good people. Dick Russell is one of those people, in my judgment. He wrote a book called The Man Knew Too Much in 1991, and he mentioned this whole letter. And then there's a gentleman called Malcolm Blunt. And I mention this to you because the government, the claims they make are totally off the wall. No evidence ever, and the evidence is to the contrary, as I stated initially. There's this fellow, Malcolm Blunt, he's known as the best qualified archive document researcher, and he said, I have no problem verifying the McCone Rally document. Everything on it is heading and file numbers are official and were used before McCone's connotation and is similar to other memos. The only thing to maybe question is the signature. It looks like a copy. However, the copy to the public is from a copy, if that makes sense. So anyway, the point is, it's a legitimate document. It's a shocking document. And no matter how they play it, it's not going to go away. So that, let's get us into the following, really, right now.
Hold that before, so I don't have to cut you off in the middle. I don't know what it is. Do you find that time in your world goes faster? Because when you're with us, time goes faster.
Well, I want to tell you something. Not only does it go faster, I believe there's probably a conspiracy somewhere.
Yes!
Every
yes.
day is Friday here.
That's what's happening. That's what's happening. Oh, my God. It's just bizarre. All right. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, the time traveler. You have to write a new book about that. And he is here with us at We the People. And we have got the previous show we did with him, which was only an hour. Imagine how much we got covered there. And then this show. And then, of course, we'll have future shows, so we'll add those on here as well. You can find them at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much.
With a plain and simple dream. Wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their mansion suitcases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on. Got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my weapon drawn. So I get my handcuffs, my cyanide pills, my classified dossier. Coming the phones like, yeah. Shredding the files like, yeah. And then my rise to all the enemy spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA.
Had to be said.
Robert, I feel like we know you well enough. We can play some Weird Al now. We can come clean now.
I'm with you.
All right. Back to the story.
Okay, here we go. I wanted to mention a place where you can get testimony that I've given, and that was in the JFK Records Act of 1992. That was sort of done as a result of what Stone was doing with the movie JFK. He puts in a tremendous amount of information. It's almost impossible, if you haven't been studying this, to really get what he's out there for. I mean, I told Stone I hate his politics. He's an American hater. But he put out as much evidence as you can get into this film. It's all scrambled out, but it's there. And again, you'd only recognize it if you had done this kind of exercise that we're doing over a period of time. But in 1993, they created the Assassination Record Review Board, and they asked me to testify in front of it. And it happened to be from a district court judge who was the chair of it, I believe from Minnesota. And what's going on with Minnesota? That's another story, I'll tell you that one. But anyway, this fellow would seem to be a very, very decent gentleman, district court judge, and he asked if I would testify. I said, oh, you know, ask me any questions you want, and I'll be delighted to give you answers, assuming that they're highly relevant to what's going on here. I don't have any secrets. And so I gave testimony, and the basic line of the testimony was what they should do with all these documents. And I said back then, give over everything. The public has the absolute right to see what happened here with the JFK case. And don't tell me they can't handle the truth. Please, please, please. You know, it would make great movie moment if you can't handle the truth stuff. So I did this, and it's all right there for you to read if you're so interested in that. And
this is at the National Archives in the
yes.
Okay,
exactly.
I'm putting a link up as we speak.
It's the Assassination Record Review Board, 1993, and what happened is that I'm still going to answer this question, by the way, about why I wrote this book. I haven't forgotten it. Trust me. And if we have to stay for the next 3 hours, I'll do it for you, believe me.
This is anyway. Great. This is like the leave behind, and then we can just do it all again because we're totally up for it.
Oh, you're great. You're great. Anyway, what happened then was, to show you how the government, and we're going to get to the truth of Daily Plaza in a second, but I did want to mention something to you about the nature of the lies that the government talks about. And they know they're lying. And if you get a page 37 of the Forensic Medical Panel report, dated in and around August/78, page 37 of the Forensic Medical Panel report of 8/78. This is when the committee, Spring and I, were not there. And by the way, when we left, the first persons that were hired by this fellow who took over, a professor type, never tried a case in his life or investigated a murder case. Perfect to get your teeth into that, you know, by taking over this case. And he wrote in his report the following in substance. Parkland doctors must have been mistaken about seeing an avulsive head wound because all 26 witnesses at Bethesda during the autopsy did not see the head injury. Now keep in mind, JFK's head is hit from the right front in the Knoll Hill area, in the stockade fence, and it snaps back and to the left. That's what we see. That's what we see. It's not what I'm telling you. It's the way that's what we see in the film.
Right.
It said snaps back and to the left and rests in Mrs. Kennedy's right shoulder. And so let me repeat that. The Parkland doctors must have been mistaken when they saw the avulsive head wound, because all the 26 witnesses at Bethesda during the autopsy did not see the head injury. All 26 Bethesda witnesses saw the gaping hole in the back of the president's head. And they also get this. Not only did they see the gaping hole, but they notified the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And page 37 is part of that report. You know what happens when you get this kind of evidence in a case, this coupled also with the McCone letter, the McCone document? You look up heavenly and you say, thank you, God. I can take over from here. That's what it's like when you try these cases, because they're so overwhelming in what happened. Now let's quickly go to the Daily Plaza of the truth. Remember, keep in mind, the government says three shots from the back, from the stockade, from the depository window, and one hit the president in the back with a downward track, which is very important here. And the other one hit him in the head. Here's what happened. There were not three shots. There were five shots. And what's amazing about it is when you try so many cases as I had and so on, you don't wait for a witness to come forward and say, hey, what? You know, I saw Bob Tannenbaum there, and I can make a positive identification. He had a pistol in his hand kind of thing. That's not what this is about when you talk to witnesses at a scene. And what did the witnesses say? There were two flurries, they said. We think there were three two or three shots in the first flurry. And Kennedy and Connolly were both hit in the back. Keep in mind, Kennedy was hit, it was a downward track, according to what we see. And they said it happened very fast, the witnesses said, of these two or three shots. Well, what they didn't know was, I was able to go frame by frame, and it was 2.6 seconds. The entire shooting sequence is about 8.3 seconds.
Holy.
Struck Kennedy and Connolly in the back. And then the witnesses said, there was a pause. The pause was 4.8 seconds. They didn't know that. Then, on this downward track, the Zapruder film shows at frame Z, as in Zapruder, 313. This is a critical, critical frame. It's the fourth shot, causing a boom blast from the right front Knoll Hill stockade fence area in close proximity to where Zapruder was filming. It struck Kennedy in his right temple, above his right ear, and it caused his head to snap back violently. And he left him basically immobile, bodily depressed, and slumped dead in Mrs. Kennedy's shoulder. Now, why is that so important? When this happened, the government ran into a big problem. And the problem was the following. They claimed that the murder weapon, as you may recall, was the Mount Nicholl County rifle. And now keep in mind, the Parkland doctors, like the chief of neurosurgery, was in charge. He observed a gaping hole in the back of the prisoner's head. And he said it's to the lower right occipital bone area in the back of our head, if you put your hand in the back of your head. And I saw the cerebellum, said Dr. Clark. Robert McClellan, who's a doctor at Parkland, drafted this vivid diagram depicting the gaping hole in the back of the prisoner's head. So why? None of these witnesses were called by the Warren Commission. Why is that? And in addition, Dr. Robert Shaw was a thoracic surgeon who handled Connolly's thoracic wounds. And what he said was, as you know, when you see an autopsy being done, the doctor is speaking into a microphone just to get all the facts down. And within an hour or so, the government had a lot of information. And some of the information was the following. Robert Shaw said that there was a 27-degree declination, a bullet in a downward track that was an in-and-out wound. And that track to Connolly and to Kennedy, both of them, the 27-degree declination from the rooftop at the County Records Building in the northeast corner of Elm Street. Remember that car making a left-hand turn onto Elm, the limo, was going northbound on Houston, and then made the left onto Elm. It was directly to the rear of the president's limo to the point of entry in Connolly's back. Let me repeat that. Shaw found and noted that there was a 27-degree declination from the bullet wound suffered by Kennedy and Connolly. Well, they also then checked the County Records Building in the northeast corner of Elm Street. And that's right next to the book depository, which is on Elm Street. And the declination was 27 degrees from the rooftop of the County Records Building to the rear of the president's building to the point of entry into Connolly's back. Now, people want to talk about a second shooter. Here you have a situation where the people involved in this investigation realized that there was more to this thing than they thought about. And here we have, from the County Records Building, it's a clean shot right down Elm Street. There's no interference with shrubbery or any angles. And right from the rooftop to the point of entry, to the rear of the limo in Connolly's back was 27 degrees. Okay, now, with respect to a problem that surfaced in this thing, the following occurred. In December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI found that Connolly and JFK were struck by two separate bullets. Two separate bullets, and both were shot within 1.9 seconds of each other. Well, what do you think about that? Here's what you think about it. The manual bolt action necessary to fire separate successive shots from the alleged murder weapon, the Mannlicher Carcano rifle, takes 2.3 seconds. Let me repeat that. Kennedy and Connolly were struck by two separate bullets within, they were hit within 1.9 seconds. In order for that Mannlicher Carcano rifle to fire separate successive shots from the Mannlicher Carcano, takes 2.3 seconds. What does that tell us? The Mannlicher Carcano, which the government has alleged for 62 years is the murder weapon, could not have fired both shots. So what happened?
And you knew that at the time.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So the CIA then ordered, get this, Arlen Specter, who was a political then in Philadelphia. This is before he became DA and a senator. Let me just say his politics were, when he ran for a DA in Philly, he was a Democrat. When he ran statewide to get the Pittsburgh vote, one could suggest, he ran, this is a state senator, United States senator, he ran as a Republican. But the CIA then knew that he would help them out, if you will. And they directed him to come up with the one bullet theory. Now, what is that? This theory is a sham, a fabrication, and scientifically invalid. Why? Because of the following. I repeat now for at least a third time that the shot that hit Connolly and JFK in the back was a downward track. This one bullet theory, as conceived in March of 64 by Specter, said that the bullet that was traveling at 1,800 feet per second from the rifle, according to what the government says, had to move upward. Remember the downward track that I keep talking about here? The bullet was in a downward track, meaning its point of entry was above the point of exit, or would have been above the point of exit had it been an exit. So the question is, how does this bullet get out from the throat of JFK? The one bullet theory. And what the government has laid out is that, notwithstanding the fact that this was a downward track in JFK's body, that the track became vertical. It moved upward 11 degrees. Imagine this. You understand what I'm just telling you here? That the bullet it stopped its downwardness and miraculously came up and spent itself out the throat of Kennedy and struck Connolly in the rib and fractured his axial nerve in his right wrist. And only in this case can a bullet that is moving downward, because the bullet was at least 5 to 6 inches below the neckline, and it was downward. Again, the point, meaning the point is higher at entry than it's, and lower at the downward track area. And that bullet, then they claim, the government claimed this. They still do. And they say that, well, you know what happened? The bullet moved up 11 degrees straight up towards his throat, exited his throat, struck Connolly in the ribs and fractured his axial nerve, and severed the tendon between his right thumb and his index finger on the right hand. So, now, the positive evidence in the case is what we call minute metallic fragments. What are they? These we see in the three skull x-rays, which I implore you to see. It's a long, narrow rectangle. And it shows the path, the direction of the minute metallic fragments. Now, and what are they? If I was shot in the back of the head right now, there would be no minute metallic fragments above my right ear, as was the case with JFK, where he was struck initially. How do we know that? Because not only does the framing of the minute metallic fragments in this rectangular, which is superimposed, these x-rays are superimposed on JFK's head, is that the three skull x-rays show a gray cloud near the center of the fragment trail, and it extends across the top of the skull, the fourth shot. And it tells us the direction and the point of entry of the fourth shot, which to this day our government never mentions. And so you know what they did? They gelatinized 10 skeletons as to have the same substance of a real skull. and they shot at the same height and distance as at the book depository nonsense. And guess what happened? They hit the skulls, and what they were, and the skulls were hit from the back. And which direction do you think the skulls moved? Quick answer: they moved forward.
Mm-hmm.
If someone came in and hit me with a bat in the side of my front head, of my head would move to the left side. Keep in mind, when you analyze all this, from what I'm chatting with you about, the head has moved the body all the time with respect to the force applied to it. It's not the body moving and the head moving on along. It's not that at all. The head is moving the body because of the shots to the head and everything that else happened with respect to the head in this case. So that tells us what the problem was and what they thought would be the explanation for this. And what they did was, the government, it was even more pernicious.
Hold that thought, Robert. I hate to cliffhanger you, but if we don't take a break, we'll be at the end of the hour, and then I'll be in trouble. So, quick break. Right back. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, and you're listening to We the People Radio.
.us.
Robert. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum. So we've got the government hid the fourth shot. They did some tests from the depository, which everybody kind of figured out a long time ago that didn't make sense. Did they think people were really going to buy it? Like in real time, when you were looking at this, was it like, what the heck? No one's going to believe this. Uh-oh.
The positive evidence is so overwhelming. For example, I give you a quick aside here is that there's another doctor, Dr. Charles Gregory, who was checking out fragments that hit Connolly's wrist and were removed for comparison with the so-called magic bullet. That is Commission Exhibit CE-399, this pristine bullet, allegedly. And Connolly's wound shattered his wrist, as I mentioned, his radial nerve, and cut the tendon, fully leading to his right hand. And remember, he was holding this Stetson hat, if you recall, and you see it in the film, and he was holding it like upside down. All he had to do was with his right hand is flip it up and put it on. And throughout all the shooting, as a major piece of corroboration, he never dropped the Stetson hat until he was hit with the fragment that became what we call the fifth shot. And that was the shot that hit Kennedy in the cowlick area above his, in the back of his head. And it would happen 7/10 of a second after the fourth shot. And I had worked with a photographic expert consultant, Bob Grodin, and at frame 255, you see, it's so helpful to have all these frames, because in frame 255, we see no damage to the windshield. What's the significance of that? It tells us that the first flurry happened between frames 224 and 230. And we did not detect a flare that we detected at frame 313. That's the shot that hit Kennedy in the head and blew the back of his head off. And that's what the Parkland doctors were talking about, the damage that he suffered in the back of his head being blown off. So the fourth shot killed him. And what was the substance of the third shot? The third shot, I maintain that we should see a flare in the film, as we see it at 313, And we should see it basically at frame 328. And that's the fifth shot, 0.7 seconds after the fourth shot. And what we did was we went frame by frame. And in going frame by frame, we did away with the government's other major lie, and that was called neutron activation analysis, NAA, N as in Nancy, AA, neutron activation analysis, which is alleged to be the principal testing component of CBLA, comparative bullet lead analysis, CBLA. And the only government, the only lab that did any of this testing was the government. Now, what was the testing they were doing? They were claiming that there were two bullets, really, in this whole case. And this is what NAA proves, they say. And what does that mean? It means that the shots that were fired were analyzed as neutron activation analysis. Remember, the principal testing components were comparative bullet lead analysis. And they claimed there were two large fragments in the limo. They came from one bullet. That's one bullet. Because the fragments match fragments, they said. And this is science that's talking about here. And then the Connelly removal of fragments to the so-called magic bullet, the pristine bullet, you can match fragments to a bullet. Well, no one bothered to speak to the real experts. These were the PhDs in metallurgy. Every one of them that was spoken to that I'm aware of said that you cannot compare a fragment to a fragment. That goes the whole thing in the window in the limo. That there was that one bullet that fragmented and they matched each other. Can't do it. And that you can't match a fragment to a bullet. And that's the bullet, the pristine bullet that they're matching with respect to NAA. So they went around bragging. They have testing here. If you don't believe the science of this case, they argued, you believe the Earth is flat. This is literally what they said. So Bob Groder and I went through frame by frame of all these hits. And we concluded the following, based upon what we observed. We finally saw the flare at frame 328. You see? 328. And that was the fragment impact revealed in the fifth shot that hit Connelly, that hit JFK in the cowl at the top of his head, and it caused his head to move forward. And it enlarged the wound of the fourth shot. And you see the damage to the interior, what I call the flare, at frame 328, that just damage to the limo interior windshield to the left of the rearview mirror. And the last fragment hit Connelly's right wrist and severed the tendon in his hand, the axial nerve in his wrist, and caused him to drop the Stetson hat. Every expert you speak to about this case, who knows anything about anything, understands what I just told you, and you don't have to be an expert to figure all this stuff out. It's right there in front of you. And particularly when we see the flare again, to the interior of the limo windshield, to the left of the rearview mirror. And so that in large measure is what the government has done here. I mean, this NAA thing, this neutron activation analysis, is the ultimate ending of their lying. And too bad in the sense that we've had enough lies from the government.
Yeah.
The problem with this case is, I consider it the most important case in criminal justice in American history. Why do I say that grandiose comment? Because we know who killed Lincoln, unfortunately. I say unfortunately. I'm talking about the fact that Abraham Lincoln is an incredible human being sent by God. Believe me, I believe that. This man, uneducated man, I want you to know. He was murdered, and we know where and when. We do not know who in Dealey Plaza murdered the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. It's heartbreaking. And the government is part and parcel of the lie. That's the presentation that I think you were waiting for me to give you. I hope it was. Because that's all I got left in the engine right now.
That's a great point, because we don't know who the shooters were.
Exactly.
Do you think that's why they waited so long?
Well, I mean, they can wait all they want. It's embarrassing, though, isn't it? For me to tell you, hey, we're waiting for some, we're waiting for a piece of ammo from Evident. What? They've lied to this day for 62 years.
Yeah.
You think maybe they washed, and you think maybe they, you had someone, they, you had Miss Ellen Ryan, who testified, hypothetically. And that, you know what they've done, based upon the information I have? They decided they didn't like what you said in your testimony, so they changed your testimony but kept your name. That's what's going on here with this CIA nonsense. And it's the worst. It's the worst. It has nothing to do with Elon Musk and all the good things he's trying to do. You can't have the government run by bureaucrats who are not elected people. It's one thing for the agency people to make recommendations to, whether it's Article 1 or Article 2. It's fine. That's what it's all about. And they make their recommendations to the president about national security and other important issues. But not to have someone just do whatever the hell they want, create their own, they, you know, there's a case, Raimondo, is that the case? It was recently a case that the Supreme Court handled that talked about this very issue, that the government has no business permitting agencies to make rules, which is like legislation, because it's a violation of Article 1. They're making legislation up, and they have not been elected to do that. And they have sanctions. If you violate their rules, they have sanctions. Well, who gave them that authority? Lazy members of the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And if you want to know about oversight, I'll leave you with this. The great Chucky Schumer, the senator from New York, unfortunately, said about President Trump when he took on the executive intelligence agencies, wanted to know some answers to things. What did Schumer say? This is chief of oversight in the United States Senate. He says, I thought that, you know, Trump was a savvy guy. Well, no one savvy or smart is going to take on the executive intelligence agencies because they got 8 ways to Sunday to get back at you.
Yep.
Yeah.
And nothing but time.
And when I told Lou Stokes about the notion of why did you hire me routine, I was basically referring in my mind to the attitude of the government. And that is that they decide who to hand off to try and keep their distance if there's any flack. And no one is raising the points that were just mentioned by the United States Supreme Court, that having unelected officials get involved in legislation and in sanctions for violation of their own legislation, which is a violation of the First Amendment. They should all be reminded in Washington, the First Amendment is with respect to legislation. It has to do with legislation. And the people we want legislation to be done by and for are the legislators who are elected for the people. God knows the havoc they make with respect to what they do and they don't do. So that's about the story and its limitations. I would have hoped everybody goes to Amazon right now and gets at least 5 books on delivery.
They should.
That's what's going on. The book, everything I've mentioned to you in detail is in my book, That Day in Dallas. Oswald Did Not Kill the President. So I would urge, you know, people, if you're really interested in this, please get my book. I lay it all out for you. And I have exhibits that are dynamite, wonderful exhibits, that pictorially tell you the story. And all these different frames that I refer to, frame 313, where you see President's head getting blown off. You know, someone should ask the whole Warren Commission, how come you didn't put on any of these Parkland doctors? And why haven't you told the American public that his head snapped back? When's the last time someone got shot in the back of the head and his head went backwards?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think we all learned that, in fifth grade in science?
Something like that.
That's terrible. Like that. That's just...
Anyway, I do want to thank you guys for giving me this chance to expound upon these facts. It's very important as far as I'm concerned.
It's super important. And there's a lot of noise out there about this topic. I've listened to a lot of different interviews, usually briefly, because they're silly and boring and don't have any detail, and your info is awesome and helpful. So we're going to talk about some of your other books on a different day, but can you believe it? We're out of time. I know, what a shock. But Robert Tannenbaum, you can come and tell us a story absolutely any day Well, any Sunday, how about that? Because that's the only day we're here.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. We will chat with you again. So if you have missed this or you want to send it to a friend, you can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.